And so we've moved into a situation now where we have to make our own ice, so to speak.
How a hotter October is treating ice around the northernmost city in the country. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 12th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Alaska firefighters are being sent to battle the raging wildfires in California.
With the activities they got going down there, those fires and the severity of them, there is a shortage of resources, so they have had to reach out to other areas.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska wants to remind residents that open enrollment for individual and family health plans is now through December 15th. Many Alaskans qualify for a tax credit on their premiums to help lower the cost of coverage, and according to a study by KF Foundation, average tax credits for Alaskans who qualified in 2017 were over $700 a month. So learn more and estimate your tax credit at Primera.com. This message sponsored by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska.
Mike Dunleavy will be sworn in as the next Alaska governor in Norvik. The Northwest Arctic Borough Village is where his wife, Rosie Dunleavy, is from. Dunleavy announced the location on Saturday to the Alaska Outdoor Council in Fairbanks. A release from Dunleavy's transition team said the governor-elect chose Norvik to honor residents of rural Alaska. Dunleavy will be the third governor in Alaska history to be sworn in outside of the state capital in Juneau. Sarah Palin and Sean Parnell had their ceremonies in Fairbanks. Dunleavy's swearing in will be on December 3rd. He will hold his inaugural celebration the next day in Wasilla, where he lives. Dunleavy's transition team will announce celebrations in other communities as the details are confirmed. Dunleavy will be appointing a replacement for the Superior Court judge ousted in this year's general election. Judge Michael Corey's term in office ends 90 days after the election. Corey is barred from applying to be a judge in Alaska for 4 years. Alaska Judicial Council Director Suzanne DiPietro says the council will begin the process of recommending qualified applicants to replace Corey. Alaska voters rejected Corey after he signed off on a plea deal that let a 34-year-old man serve only 1 year of home confinement for what many people considered a sexual assault. Corey, before the election, addressed voters in a short video and said judges must follow the law even when it produces a result they strongly dislike. Well, it was once headed to be mothballed with its sister ship, but the fast vehicle ferry Fairweather appears likely to return to service in southeast Alaska next summer, at least according to a proposed schedule released Friday by the Alaska Marine Highway System. The MV Fairweather would make 3 runs a week between Juneau, Haines, and Skagway, plus a weekly run to Sitka from May to September. The State Marine Transportation Advisory Board's chair, Robert Venables, welcomed the news.
We're just really glad to see that it didn't get mothballed and, you know, put out the pasture, as it were. So it's still in working condition and was put up that way at the end of the season this year. And I'm kind of glad to see that it's available for use next year.
The future of the fast ferries, which are capable of making runs in half the time of the rest of the fleet, has been uncertain. The 14-year-old catamarans are expensive to run and can be difficult to maneuver in choppy conditions. Cost-cutting by the ferry system has left the Fairweather's sister ship, Chenega, tied up since 2015. The schedule also doesn't anticipate the new Alaska-class ferries to go into service before September. Originally ordered as day boats by the Parnell administration, those ferries are having crew quarters added to extend their service range. The proposed schedule isn't final. The Marine Highway System is asking for written feedback on the draft schedule by November 23rd. Some Alaskans are helping with the California wildfire response. Alaska Division of Forestry spokesman Tim Mowry says the state is one of several being tapped for assistance through the National Interagency Coordination Center.
With the activities they got going down there, those fires and the severity of them, there is a shortage of resources, so they have had to reach out to other areas.
Mowry says Alaska firefighting crews disband for the winter, but some fire management professionals are available to fill a variety of response jobs in California.
So mostly it's management and overhead, safety officers, field observers, division supervisors. There was an order for a public information officer the other day. but mainly it's management and supervisory positions.
Mowry says the assignments are for 2 weeks, but can be extended an additional week.
You know, given the situation in California and the volatility of these fires and the fuels down there, who knows? Who knows how long these events are going to go on?
Mowry says the extreme situation in California is hard to comprehend in a sparsely populated state like Alaska.
How, you know, they can be evacuating, you know, half the state of Alaska, essentially. So anything we can do to help them, we're going to do.
31 are known dead in wind-driven wildfires in northern and southern California. Hundreds more people are missing, and thousands of homes and businesses have been destroyed. If you want to see some of the most dramatic change in the part of the world that's changing most dramatically, Utqiagvik is in the fall is a good contender. Over the course of the past 50 years, temperatures in Utqiagvik have increased in October more than any other month, and the sea ice pattern has changed drastically. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig has this story about how that temperature rise is linked to changing ice conditions and what that looks like through the eyes of one man who's lived there all his life.
The sky is close and gray as Billy Adams stands on the shore in Utqiagvik at the end of October, looking out at the Chukchi Sea. There's semi-frozen rain falling from the sky, waves crashing on shore, and open water as far as the eye can see. Adams is a hunter. He's in his 50s, and he says that when he was growing up, there was almost always ice attached to the shore by now.
When you were younger, if you were looking out here, there would have been enough ice out on that ocean that you could go out walking on it.
Yeah, we could have been walking out there and hunting ring seals, but we're on land right now.
That lack of ice is both the effect of warming in the Arctic broadly and a primary driver of local October warming in Utqiagvik. That's according to Rick Toman, a climatologist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
When you've got that water right offshore that's staying at 28 or warmer, that greatly limits how cool the air can get. Even a thin layer of ice with a little bit of snow on it, the air right above that can cool much more.
What used to happen usually in October is that the pack ice that was able to remain frozen on the Arctic Ocean throughout the summer would start getting blown to shore. It would cool the land and the water around it, which helped to form even more ice along the coastline. But the edge of that pack ice has been steadily retreating further north. Where even 2 decades ago it was rare for the ice to be more than 50 miles from the coast in October, now it's often hundreds of miles offshore. Which means that these days in October, it's beyond the range where normal wind patterns can blow it in.
And so we've moved into a situation now where we have to make our own ice, so to speak.
In other words, the ice has to form in place along the coast without the help of pack ice. And that takes more time. Back on the shore in Utqiagvik, Billy Adams tells me that the ice now tends to form in late November or December instead of October like it used to. The effect of that? Besides shortening the hunting season on the ice, the new ice pattern has also contributed to increased coastal erosion along the unprotected shore, with potentially serious consequences for Utqiagvik's infrastructure. For Adams himself, however, the biggest consequence of no October ice is simply that he misses it. For him, it's hallowed ground.
You find your own place out there and pray and ask for, you know, comfort, and a lot of the time I go out there and heal out there from all the things that go on in the world. I just like to be alone with the Creator and enjoying his world.
Do you ever worry that future generations won't get that?
You know, I'm not going to worry about it right now. You know, that's not in my thoughts right now. I'm not going to worry. You know, they're going to do fine. You know, we have to be positive.
Ice on the Chukchi Sea is only now forming, and freeze-up is still weeks away. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, utter shock among Anchorage cyclists surprised to see a cow on the trails.
I was like, am I seeing things? I've never seen loose cows in winter night biking in Anchorage.
A bovine on the run. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Do you need health insurance but think you can't afford it? Well, did you know that Alaska's individual market health insurance premiums are going down again for 2019? If you need insurance or currently have insurance through the individual market, be sure to shop at healthcare.gov between November 1st and December 15th to confirm that you have the plan that best meets your family's budget and coverage needs. You may also call 1-844-PLANS-AK for local help. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
That cow story is coming up, but now to Mustang, an oil field on the North Slope. It's gotten millions of dollars in state-backed loans over the last 6 years. The loans have been restructured, payment deadlines have been extended, and still no oil from the Mustang field. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, Rasha McChesney has this story.
The Mustang field is pretty unremarkable in that it looks like the rest of the North Slope. Flat tundra as far as the eye can see, and on top, all the signs of the oil industry. A gravel road and a big pad, some equipment. What is remarkable about this field is the type of investment that it's gotten in the past decade. Specifically, about $95 million in state or state-backed loans. Before we get to that, there are a few things to know. This is not a story about a field that doesn't have any oil. It's right next to the second largest oil field in North America, and Mustang is estimated to hold more than 25 million barrels of oil. The field is operated by a small, independent oil company, Brooks Range Petroleum Corporation. The company plans to hire a few hundred people this winter, put in a small, quick production facility, and start producing in early 2019. And its president and CEO, Bart Armfield, says oil is coming soon. But it has taken the better part of a decade to get to this point.
What happened?
What happened to the whole industry is oil price fell from 120 plus to $30 a barrel.
He's not blaming all of the project's delays on low oil prices. There were some technical problems too. But now, oil prices have rebounded somewhat, and the Mustang field could be well on its way to paying off some of its bills next year. Here's the thing. There are a lot of outstanding bills, and untangling who exactly is responsible for paying what back is not easy. For starters, Brooks Range Petroleum operates the Mustang project, but it does not fully own it. Just who owns which part is a web of companies and subsidiaries, and right in the middle is ADA, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. That's the state corporation that finances in-state projects. When ADA bought into the Mustang field in 2013, it tried something different with Brooks Range. Instead of just investing or loaning money into the field, ADA formed a corporation. That ADA-owned corporation built the road and pad leading out to the Mustang field. ADA did it again a year later. It formed another corporation to build an oil processing facility. Altogether, the state corporation put about $72 million into developing and maintaining that field. But by 2015, there was still no oil coming out of it. That means no money coming in to recoup ADA's investment. Remember that big crash in oil prices? Well, in 2015, they were in a free fall. That's when the Department of Revenue stepped in and gave one of those state-owned corporations a $22.5 million line of credit. Think of it as a bridge loan, something to keep the Mustang field afloat until things got better. And since that company was 96% owned by ADA, this was basically one part of the state loaning money to another part of the state. Also, the collateral for that loan was tax credits that the state owes to the corporation. This is convoluted, so I'll repeat it. The state and a state-owned corporation carry almost $95 million worth of debt and nearly all of the risk of default on that debt for the Mustang field. This was, and still is, unusual. The Mustang field is the only one to get a loan like that from the Department of Revenue. Over at the Department of Revenue, Deputy Commissioner Mike Barnhill has been trying to sort it out.
Does it say in the file whose idea it was?
It does not. And I don't know.
What would be a good place to start looking to find out whose idea it was?
So I believe I've reviewed all of the files within the Department of Revenue. There's a pending public records request for emails that I don't have access to. So it may be that the emails reveal the genesis of the idea.
That public records request? It came from Jeff Landfield, a blogger who runs the site Alaska Landmine. Landfield says he doesn't understand why the state would make a loan to bail a state-backed corporation out.
So I started digging into it and trying to figure out what happened. And then the more I dug into it, the more I realized it was like, I think fishy is a good term, you know?
Landfield works in the oil industry, and he says he considers it blatant favoritism. He wants to know why that loan wasn't offered to any other companies when oil prices were down and the whole industry was suffering. He's not the only one asking questions. Sitka Senator Bert Stedman also wants to know why that loan was made. He's launched a legislative audit. Stedman says it can't be changed now, but he thinks Alaskans should know how their money was spent.
I don't think we need to make excuses, you know, why this project was done. It was done. You know, all the players are changed, so it's not a hanging party. It's just sort it out and go on.
That loan still hasn't been paid back, and it's not clear when that's going to happen. The Department of Revenue asked Ada to take over the loan, but that hasn't happened. For now, Barnhill says there's a deal in the works to extend the payment deadline again.
Until when?
So it gets a little complicated.
It's all complicated.
The loan could be extended until December of 2020. And it's not just the Department of Revenue that wants out from under its loan to the Mustang Field. The Ada board voted to sell its ownership interest, too. That leaves ownership and operation to a handful of companies and Brooks Range. And Bart Armfield is okay with that. He says Brooks Range has a clear path to getting its oil out of the ground and is well on its way to making some money so it can pay its bills. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
In October, the Haynesboro Police Department was ordered to not provide service outside the Haynes town site. Since then, there have been several incidents reported to the police department that have gone without responses, including car accidents and a home invasion. At a meeting last Tuesday, the Haynesboro Assembly reversed the order. KHNS's Henry Leisha has more.
Haynesboro Charter limits the local police department to serve only within the boundaries of the town site. Since the Alaska State Troopers removed their sole blue shirt officer from the Haynesboro last year, the Assembly has been trying to figure out how police service can be provided outside the town site. In October, a proposal was brought before voters living in the borough but outside of town. The idea was to fund a new on-call police service area by increasing their property taxes, but it was rejected. As a result, the Haynesboro Police Department was ordered to not provide service outside the Haynes town site. For 2 weeks, reports of emergencies outside the town boundaries went without responses. At a meeting Tuesday, the Haynes Assembly decided police can respond to calls outside the town site if there is an articulable crime in progress or an imminent threat to life or property. During the meeting, the Assembly discussed whether the state troopers are failing to fulfill a legal obligation to provide service to the borough. The Assembly voted to have the borough's attorney write a letter addressing the question of the troopers' jurisdiction to Major Andrew Greenstreet, the acting director of the Alaska State Troopers. In Haynes, I'm Henry Leisha.
Everyone who fishes likely has had personal experience that doesn't exactly square with the projections of fish and game. In fact, fisheries management in Alaska is almost entirely a numbers game in which ordinary people's observations play little to no role at all. That could change. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the University of Alaska are involved in a study that they hope leads to the integration of human experience into fisheries management. As KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports, ongoing research in Sitka could create a model statewide for what scientists call integrated ecosystem assessment.
Last year, in a story produced by National Public Radio's Melissa Block for her series Our Land, Sitka troller Charlie Wilbur was asked if climate change was affecting his ability to harvest king salmon. Here's how Wilbur responded.
It's really hard to pin it down to say this is climate change, but things are definitely changing.
Wilbur, like almost all of us, isn't qualified to speak on climate science, but nearly four decades on the water have made him, and Alaskans like him, a top expert in his own environment. NOAA Fisheries now wants to capture and quantify that expertise, says social scientist Marisha Shimkoviak.
Fishermen have a real vast understanding of their local marine ecosystems and their fisheries because they're highly dependent on them. And they're out there every day, and they know these things to a degree that, you know, it's really hard for us to understand and capture to the same degree.
But you don't have to be a career fisherman to connect with the ecosystem. When a fishery has a poor season, everyone feels it in different ways.
Community members more broadly understand how changes in their local ecosystem and their fisheries can really reverberate throughout the community. So they'll know the the layers of the connections of the community to fisheries, where there might be buffers against changes in the ecosystem and what may break those kinds of buffers.
NOAA, or the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is the scientific agency that supports the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. The council oversees fishing in the Gulf of Alaska beyond the state limit for species like black cod and halibut, both of which are of major importance to Sitka. Shimkoviak says the council is pressing NOAA to provide indicators of community well-being that reach beyond direct economic indicators, or the kinds of harvest and market data traditionally used to manage fisheries. And so the Integrated Ecosystem Assessment Model was designed, and Sitka was chosen as the site.
Sitka is one of the most important fishing-related communities in Alaska, and it's a unique community in terms of its fishing fleet, in terms of its people, in terms of the economic and environmental vulnerabilities that it currently has.
Judith Rossellon is a biologist with the University of Alaska Fairbanks who is teaming up with the social scientist Shimkoviak to develop the integrated assessment model. They both visited Sitka in April to define the links between community well-being and the fisheries. They're coming back this month to figure out how to measure them. The goal is to introduce human metrics into the data-rich science of fisheries management.
It's not going to change the way that we manage the fisheries tomorrow, but it's definitely going to add pieces of knowledge to the current management process. And with that knowledge, then we can start doing a better and more informed fisheries management.
And that means managers might begin to understand the data that Alaska's subsistence, sport, and commercial fishermen, like Charlie Wilbur, have been collecting every time they leave the dock.
Water temperatures are warmer. We've seen species of fish that don't ordinarily get up this far.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Turtles, we've seen some pomfret.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. One out of three U.S. adults has prediabetes, but 90% of them don't even know they have it. The good news is you can prevent type 2 diabetes by acting early. Learn your risk for prediabetes by taking a short quiz at diabetes.alaska.gov. If you're at risk, you can enroll in a free online program called Turnaround Health. The program will help you eat better, be active, and lose weight. Learn more at diabetes.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Department of Health and Social Services.
Vice President Mike Pence paid a Veterans Day visit to service members in Anchorage during a refueling stop en route to an Asia trip. Pence arrived at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson Sunday afternoon after his plane was delayed by weather. At the Anchorage base, Pence gave a brief speech before service members. He touched down in Tokyo on Monday to discuss North Korea and other issues with Japanese officials before heading to two regional summits. On Tuesday, Pence will attend a meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations in Singapore and an Asia-Pacific Economic Corporation summit in Papua New Guinea on behalf of President Trump. Drilling near Southeast Alaska's Herbert Glacier has yielded encouraging results for a Canadian mining company. Grande Portage Resources has been exploring claims 15 miles north of Juneau since 2010. It's an area of Juneau's historic gold belt that's been laid bare by the glacier's retreat. CEO Ian Klassen said his company's Herbert Gold project is still in its early phase.
At this point, it's about exploration, it's about discovery, it's about building the asset. And at this point, we're very much just involved in the exploration phase of this company's development.
The Vancouver company's filings infer as much as $400 million worth of gold in its claims.
You know, we've got six very significant mesothermal veins that you can see from surface. And, you know, we've only drill tested about 25% of those targets themselves.
Permission to drill has been granted by the U.S. Forest Service five times since 2010. Earlier this year, the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council asked the Forest Service to require a full comprehensive review rather than issue short-term permits. The agency declined. SEACC's Guy Archibald said any future mine would have consequences.
it's going to, you know, certainly impact any recreation activities up there. And then I'm also concerned that, you know, pretty much any mining operation ends up contaminating water, whether it's surface water or groundwater. And the Herbert River is a very productive river, and I would hate to see any damage done to that system.
The claims are on federal land off of the road system, but any proposal would still be reviewed by the City and Borough of Juneau. Even if a mine were eventually developed, Klassen said people would hardly know it was there.
This is the type of thing that would be an underground operation without an expression at surface that would be an eyesore. So, you know, the community doesn't have to fear us.
Work has wrapped up for the season. Klassen said the company plans to return next summer. Well, some would-be cow wranglers' work isn't done at last report. Anchorage cyclists were perplexed recently when a bovine creature turned up on a popular Anchorage bike trail. Sure, it's not unusual to encounter a cow moose on a trail around here, but wild Alaska cows, that's not usually a thing. Alaska Public Media's Abby Collins reports.
Eric Parsons bikes along trails near the Campbell Airstrip regularly. But on a recent ride, he saw something pretty unusual. Parsons saw a big animal out of the corner of his eye, and it startled him.
As I'm riding by it, I notice that it's not a moose and it's not a bear. And I'm like, are my eyes playing tricks on me? And it definitely, in my mind, I could see that it was a big black cow.
Parsons isn't talking about a cow moose. Parsons wondered if his mind was playing tricks on him.
And I was just like, could that have really been a cow? Because I was like, am I seeing things? I've never seen loose cows in winter night biking in Anchorage.
But then he caught word of another sighting. In a post on the Anchorage Fat Bike Facebook group, another biker wrote, quote, almost got run over by a cow last night on Moose Meadow, as in cattle, not a bear or a moose, end quote. And it appears there is indeed a missing cow in the Anchorage area. In a public Facebook post, an Anchorage resident says they've been looking for a cow for a while. They say it's, quote, a very sneaky cow and doesn't want to get caught, end quote. They declined to comment further for this story. In Anchorage, I'm Abby Collins.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Rasha McChesney, and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ravenna Koenig in Upyadvik, Henry Leisha in Haines, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Abby Collins in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. Starting October 1st, all of Alaska will be protected from the harmful effects of secondhand smoke because all public places across the state will be smoke-free. Everyone can now breathe easier as they work and play. Smoke-free workplaces and public spaces protects the health of all Alaskans. It also protects our youth from ever starting smoking. So if you do smoke or vape, please take it outside. For more information about the new smoke-free workplace law, visit smokefree.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Department of Health and Social Services. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.